I'm here talking to returning guest Julina Guo, senior staff attorney of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. And today we wanted to break down some of the history of immigration policy in the U.S., particularly looking at the reoccurring themes, the racist undertones of it. And because it's so extensive, so complex, Julina decided to pick out one part of some of the many reoccurring themes. So, Julina, welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
Could you talk about what we're looking at today, which policies we're looking at today, why it's relevant?
Yeah, thank you so much. This is such an important topic to talk about and mobilize around, given the current events that we've seen around our country, especially in light of the heinous murders and anti-Asian crimes in Atlanta. So in all frankness, it's been an important topic to address, right, long before now. Some people may think that anti-Asian racism is a relatively new phenomenon because it's now being coined as that term in the news. They might think that it wasn't even a factor in the Atlanta murders of six Asian women, or that it's only been, you know, escalated in recent years because of Trump's rhetoric around COVID-19 and how he's used phrases like Kung Flu, China virus, Wuhan virus, all unscientific terms. The reality is that the U.S. has had a long, complicated history with Asian immigrants, and the history is steeped in discrimination against Asian immigrants, which has often led to the stripping away of their legal rights in court. So today I'd like to highlight a few of the major historical trends in our culture, some of the laws that were passed by our very own Congress against Chinese immigrants and against other Asian immigrants, and then talking a little bit about Supreme Court cases that have led to the stripping away of their legal rights, as well as some political propaganda and images that we've seen throughout history directed against Asian immigrants.
So where does this start? Where do we begin in the history of the U.S.?
The Chinese Americans first entered the U.S. as primarily laborers during the mid to late 1800s. And this was because gold had been just discovered in California, and there was a rush to find cheap and immigrant labor to cultivate, to mine, and to transport the gold. So that's where the influx of Chinese immigrants first occurred. And during that time, Chinese workers not only helped to mine gold and transport gold, but they were also instrumental in building railroads for this country, which allowed us to expand westward, into the coast, and were actually really important during the American Civil War, where troops used the railroads to move, you know, throughout the country and also to provide supplies throughout the country. So at the time, many Chinese immigrants actually came to the United States for the purpose of fleeing the opium wars that were occurring in their home country, which was waging between China and European powers, keeping the Chinese in the mainland, at least, addicted to this very awful drug during this illegal trade of opium. So they came in search of safety and freedom. And unfortunately, they found really neither in the United States.
Safety and freedom is often the reason that a lot of immigrants do come to the U.S. I mean, that's even why settlers came over here. I think that's a...
Absolutely.
Right? So even though Europeans were looking for safety, they didn't see other people as having the same rights to that safety and freedom.
Absolutely. There was a blatant disregard of Chinese immigrants, men and women, as human beings, honestly, and as functional members of American society when they first arrived. So almost from the get-go, they were demonized and dehumanized. Americans looked down upon Chinese men who they thought were cheap labor, taking away American jobs. You know, the same rhetoric that we often hear today pertaining to Asian immigrants, but other immigrant groups as well. And at the same time, Americans objectified and exoticized Chinese women, which is another trend that we continue to see today and that we saw very blatantly last week in the Atlanta murders. In 1875, we actually had one of the first laws that were enacted against Chinese immigrants. This was known as the Page Act, and it prohibited importation of laborers from any quote-unquote Oriental country, who were not brought to the U.S. of their own free will or who were brought for quote-unquote lewd or immoral purposes. And this is just an example of early stereotyping of Asian women who were seen as sexual objects or prostitutes. Asian women who did attempt to enter the United States had to prove that they weren't prostitutes, that they weren't coming for lewd or immoral purposes, because that was the standard that they had to overcome. So they endured often invasive and humiliating interrogations, medical exams by U.S. immigration officials just to be able to come into this country and live their lives. And of course, the result was, you know, imagine if you had to be put through that, you wouldn't want to come to this country. Why would you put yourself through that experience? It's traumatic. So the result was that fewer and fewer Chinese women actually immigrated to the United States.
And is there a little bit of white supremacy underlying here, that it isn't so much that Asian women were coming to be with their Asian men, it was that there was the mixing with the white population?
Exactly. And mainstream culture at that time really did not take a liking to that. They really saw the Chinese immigrants as apart and separate from existing society and culture. They did not want a blending of cultures. And in fact, when the Page Act was enacted, fewer Chinese women came to the States. So we had more Chinese men who were laborers, but who couldn't bring their families. So this just exacerbated the cycle of fulfilling this awful stereotype that they're not part of our society. They're bachelors or they're drifters and they're not permanent, which again led them to be seen as alien or foreign.
Did the Chinese population then try to become citizens so they weren't so much of this temporary worker? What was the next step here?
Yeah, they did try, but unfortunately, we saw another act of Congress that really put a stop to those efforts. And this was known as the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which is a notoriously heinous act that really limited the immigration of Chinese individuals into the United States. So what this act did was it created a 10-year moratorium on Chinese labor immigration, excluding skilled and unskilled laborers and Chinese individuals who were employed in mining, which was exactly what was happening with the railroad expansion. So it was a direct response to the influx of Chinese labor into the United States. It also imposed new requirements, very onerous requirements, on Chinese immigrants who were already in the United States. If they wanted to leave the country for any reason and re-enter, they had to obtain permission and certification from authorities in order to do so. And this was nearly impossible to do. In addition, they could not become United States citizens. They were barred from naturalizing to be U.S. citizens. And what's really awful is that at the end of this 10 years in 1892, instead of repealing this act or going, implementing more progressive acts to be inclusive, Congress actually extended the Chinese Exclusion Act for another 10 years and then eventually made it permanent in 1902. So for all of these decades, Chinese immigrants were not able to immigrate to the United States. And when they did, they were seen as the foreign enemy and very clearly labeled as such in mainstream culture.
So the U.S. was bringing in Chinese workers for this the amount of impact on somebody's body to do a railroad, which has been so essential in building the U.S. on stolen land. They were then a total disregard for a human, and it was just seen as laborers.
Exactly. There was no looking at them as individuals or as families. It was seen as, a source of cheap labor that was convenient to the United States at the time and that they could use to their advantage. But once it became no longer convenient and it became, what they saw as a threat, that's when they mobilized against Asian immigrants.
And you mentioned families, and I think that's still something that we hear today, is that anytime we want to other somebody, we forget that somebody is a family member, and they always are at least somebody's child. And so we still use that same kind of language to tell, especially when it comes to immigration, to other people.
Yes, absolutely. The rhetoric has not changed. We still think about people in terms of the phrase alien, right? We don't see them as undocumented or as individuals. And we forget that, before even entering one foot onto U.S. soil, This person has had a whole life lived in their home country, a rich life full of experiences and lessons and family relations and friendships and, you know, and jobs and other ties to their local community. So we've definitely failed to see them as a full person, and the rhetoric really needs to change to humanize them.
And can you give some other examples in the culture of how this rhetoric against Chinese and other Asian communities was distributed among the culture?
Yeah, so in the mid to late 1800s, as all of this was happening, and as the U.S. started to realize that it did not actually want to welcome Chinese immigrants, we saw the rise of political cartoons and propaganda that the government allowed to depict Chinese immigrants and other immigrant groups as the enemy. So in one particular cartoon, which is actually available in the Library of Congress's website, there's an image of Uncle Sam kicking Chinese men off a coast where a ship is waiting to pick them up. And the title of the cartoon is "The Magic Washer, Manufactured by GOD in Dixon, Illinois." So wow. This cartoon was to promote a laundry detergent called Magic Washer, which was manufactured in the U.S., in Illinois. And Uncle Sam is holding up a proclamation in one hand and the Magic Washer can in another hand.
Oh, wow.
Next to the laundry detergent, we see the words, "Don't use this if you want to be dirty." And so this was actually targeted towards Chinese immigrants who operated laundromats or laundering services at the time, basically saying that if you want to be dirty, you know, use the services of Chinese immigrants. But here we have this homegrown American manufactured laundry detergent that will beat everything. And the proclamation says, you know, basically all families in America should use this at the risk of being dirty.
Mm.
So we see that the Chinese men who are being kicked off this coast have very shifty looking eyes. Their features are, you know, very demonized and dehumanized. They have claws for fingernails. They're depicted in every way as lesser than this Uncle Sam figure and lesser than American ingenuity, you know, that went into this magic washer detergent. And that's just one of many examples of the propaganda at that time.
Wow. That's I'm at a loss of words after that one.
It's truly horrible. And at the bottom of the ad, it actually says the Chinese must go. If it's not, you know, clear from the image, it's right there as well at the bottom of the image, depicting exactly, you know, saying exactly what the image depicts.
It's another reoccurring concept that people use in cartoons is dirt. That's been used with also a lot of various groups. It makes you wonder who's actually behind all these soap manufacturers if they all use that same kind of racist taglines.
Yeah, right. The terminology of dirt or pure or, you know, innocent or a criminal is definitely something that has seeped into our culture even today, and it's very problematic.
Mm. In addition to looking at cleanliness when it comes to the Chinese and other Asian groups, there was also the difference in religion.
Right. So Chinese immigrants who came to the United States, you know, were usually not Christian or definitely not Catholic or Protestant, like what the type of immigrants that the United States was used to seeing. So they were often seen as religious heathens or even immoral because they didn't have a religious system that the American public understood, and with the language barrier too. So it was very easy to kind of separate them away from American culture and society and say that these are not the desirable people, quote unquote, that we would want to allow into our society.
So was the Chinese Exclusion Act ever repealed?
It was. It was finally repealed in 1943, which, if you can believe it, it was actually 61 years after it first went into effect in 1882. So for 61 years, Chinese immigrants were excluded from the United States with very, very few exceptions. And even after it was repealed, the government only allowed 105 Chinese immigrants to enter the United States per year. And this was because of the national origin system that we had at the time for our immigration law, which lasted until 1965.
And what kind of pressures resulted in the repeal of the act? I mean, what was... How was the U.S. coming together to actually put pressure to overturn these racist policies?
There were a lot of undercurrents at the time, a lot of political and international events, right, including World War II that occurred at the time. And unfortunately, World War II saw the internment of over 100,000 individuals of Japanese descent and Japanese Americans. And at the same time, because the United States had identified Japan as an enemy for that purpose, it tried to change its attitude towards China in order to be allied with them in this war effort. So we actually saw the implementation of similar political propaganda, you know, political cartoons. And there's actually political cartoons that openly mocked the Japanese and included instructions to American citizens on how they should physically distinguish someone who looks Japanese from someone who looks Chinese. And of course, using these grossly inappropriate markers, like saying that you can tell from someone's appearance or how, you know, their gait and how they walk or how they're pronunciating certain words, how they speak and their mannerisms. Of course, grossly inappropriate and openly racist. Again, dehumanizing the Japanese at the time, who they thought were the enemy. And of course, this is very ironic when you take into account the fact that even now, the United States, I would say largely, sees Asian Americans as monolithic, that they are very quick to judge based on someone's appearance and perceive that they are from a specific ethnic group, you know, accurately or not accurately, but they make that judgment. So we haven't really come that far from my personal view from where we've been. And it was just that the U.S. found advantageous at the time to elevate one ethnic group and dehumanize another. And that could change. And that has changed in our history, depending on international relations and what is most convenient for our country. Even before World War II, we saw some semblance of anti-Japanese rhetoric and sentiments in the United States. So for example, in one of the most notorious Supreme Court cases, it was called Ozawa versus United States in 1922, brought by a Japanese American who had lived in the U.S. for 20 years, but was born in Japan, was not a U.S. citizen, but considered himself to be one, given that he's grown up here and lived here for so many years. At the time, he wasn't technically eligible for citizenship because the U.S. limited that to free white persons and persons of African descent, which was the standard that they applied at the time. So Ozawa tried to apply for U.S. citizenship, but the U.S. Supreme Court actually said that he wasn't eligible for one because it only applied to Caucasians and to people of African descent, which again was the standard at that time.
And we went over that a large group of the Chinese population came as temporary laborers. What brought the influx of Japanese to the U.S.?
So I think most of the Japanese, early Japanese immigrants to the U.S. actually came through Hawaii and were coming through different industries like the sugarcane industry and other industries that were more prominent on the islands in Hawaii. And that was even before Hawaii became part of U.S. territory and definitely before it became a state.
So continuing on from the Ozawa versus U.S., what did we see happen in the U.S. after that?
After Ozawa v. U.S., we didn't really make too much progress. Just a year after, we had another court case in the U.S. Supreme Court that was brought by a Sikh man. It was called U.S. v. Tind in 1923. He was also not a U.S. citizen, and he wanted to become one. And his argument was that, well, you said in Ozawa just last year in that court case that you had to be Caucasian to be eligible for citizenship. Well, you know, based on my caste and my cultural background and my heritage, I think I culturally and linguistically qualify as Aryan and Caucasian. So I should be eligible for U.S. citizenship based on your rationale just a year ago. And unfortunately, same thing happened. The Supreme Court walked back a little bit and tried to distinguish these two cases and said that, no, you're not eligible for citizenship because linguistic commonality is not sufficient, and there is no common racial origin that's accepted in the scientific field or in popular culture. So you can't really say that you're Aryan or Caucasian enough to warrant U.S. citizenship, even if you might use those terms in other contexts, but it's not sufficient here. So Not only was this individual not granted U.S. citizenship, but it actually led to the revocation of U.S. citizenship for other Indian Americans who had already been granted that status.
Oh, wow. So we'd walk backwards then.
Exactly.
And really, as somebody who was not considered Aryan was actually understanding the system, and they didn't approve of that.
Exactly. He tried to use their rationale to say that he would be eligible based on what they said just a year ago. And, you know, they twisted it and used it in a way against him to say, well, we meant this, but actually what we really meant was, you know, there's a subsection of this that applies and then the rest doesn't apply to you. So we're going to, you know, we're not going to give that right to you.
Right, right. So do we keep then regressing after this?
Well, after World War II, you know, we really didn't see much progress either. Again, the numbers of Asian immigrants who were coming into the United States at the time were still lower than what they are now because of this national origin quota system that I was just mentioning. So the immigrants who were here were often targeted based on their race or ethnicity. And it's so ironic, I think, that we had these anti-Japanese propaganda during World War II, which purportedly tried to separate Japanese versus Chinese and, you know, elevate one ethnicity and sort of downplay the other. But in 1982, we actually had a hate crime against a Chinese American that is just so ironic given the history of propaganda that the U.S. has tried to instill in its people. And this young man was called Vincent Chin. He was in Detroit, had lived in the United States for most of his life. And at the time, the Japanese auto manufacturing industry was in competition with the U.S. And there were a lot of imports from Japan that led to a decline in jobs in the U.S. and in manufacturing in the U.S. in general. So while Vincent Chin was celebrating his bachelor party, he was about to be married, two white men walked in, and they were actually a Chrysler plant supervisor and then a laid-off auto worker who was actually the man's stepson. So they were in the U.S. auto industry and impacted by the economy at the time. Thinking that Mr. Chin was Japanese and wanting to take their anger out on the Japanese that they, you know, who they saw as the foreign enemy taking away our jobs, they beat him with a baseball bat and actually even followed him for 20 or 30 minutes after he left the establishment where the bachelor party was held. And they found him and beat him over the head so severely that he actually died of his injuries later and, of course, never got to live the rest of his life. What was especially heinous about this was that the men were charged with second-degree murder at first, but this was quickly pled down to just manslaughter. And what ended up happening was the men paid $3,000 in a fine. They served 3 years of probation and zero jail time. The whole time they alleged that it was not racially motivated at all. So, you know, this was probably not seen as a hate crime by mainstream American society at the time, but certainly to Asian American groups at the time. And now looking back, it is very clearly racially motivated that mistaking somebody who is Asian American based on their ethnicity and then attacking them because of your hostility towards that country and people of that ethnicity is a sure sign of racial bias. And following this incident, there were actually two great documentaries that were produced about this hate crime. And for anyone who's interested, they're called Who Killed Vincent Chin? And also Vincent Hu. The first one was produced several decades ago, I believe. And Vincent Hu is a more recent rendition that was produced, I believe, in 2009. But even now, you know, we're seeing strong parallels, right, between what I've just described and the news in Atlanta and New York City and San Francisco, all across our country, of anti-Asian bias and the targeting of Asian women or elderly individuals in our communities. So it's so important that we talk about this entrenched racism that's been going on in our country for so long. It's not new. It's been here since before Trump, and we must do something to educate our communities and to take action against this racism.